How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez and Dave Meltzer here on Wrestling Observer Radio. It is April 12, 2013, here at figure4online.com/WrestlingObserver.com. We are joined today by a Hall of Famer. Just went into the Hall last Saturday night.
He's been a Hall of Famer for years.
Well, that's true. But he's got his ring now. Did you send him a ring, Dave? Did you send him a ring when you put him in the Observer Hall of Fame?
I did not send him a ring. I thought he would just be happy, that the happiness would be worth as much as a ring. Except I know it wouldn't be on eBay.
That's right. That's right. Mick, how you doing today?
Good, yeah. You can't sell happiness on eBay.
Now, Mick,
I'm not a jewelry wearer, but I did wear that for a few days, and I'm going to try to find a special place in the house. It's really a very nice ring. Very happy with it.
Now, I went to Dave a couple of weeks ago, went to your comedy show. I was at the Hall of Fame at Madison Square Garden, and it was, I'm not just saying this because you're on the air, but it was an excellent speech. If somebody would have told me that you were going to go nearly an hour, I would have thought, man, that's a long time for anybody to give a speech, but you pulled it off.
I would have been surprised. I saw him go for
that long,
too.
Well, I didn't go to his comedy show.
You know what, at a certain point, I was like, wow, this show is going kind of long already. We're in our third person. We're like, you know, an hour and a half. I didn't know I was largely to blame for that. You know, I think one of the nice things is no one ever told me, you know, there were any time constraints. They really just wanted people to go out there and have fun. And even though it went 40, I think when I watch speeches, sometimes they tend to drag when guys thank too many people. And so I made a decision that I would just have like the five or six people that I was going to thank, and then get around to thanking everybody, you know, individually or in some type of, I was going to write a long article. It's called Thank You, but I haven't found the time to do that. But I know, like, when the night before, two nights before Mania, someone said, hey, I really loved your matches with Vader. And I realized, you know, how much Vader added to the DVD that's coming out. He really had some great commentary. And so I'm going out of my way, like, wait, hold on a second. And I would send Vader a message saying, thank you for being part of my DVD and for having these epic matches with me. So thank you. I did not know why I went that long. I'm glad you enjoyed it, though.
Did so this year, I mean, not only was there not the big clock on the screen, but they didn't tell you beforehand, like, hey, Mick, let's try to keep this to 30 minutes. It was just like, go do what you want to do.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, Vince never came out like Bob's speech.
He didn't come out tapping his wrist for you?
Stop me from doing it. And I didn't get any negative feedback whatsoever from anyone backstage, you know, about time. I mean, people were really happy. The only order we were given was to have fun. And when I turned, almost a year and a half ago, you know, Vince didn't think I looked like I was having fun out there. And that was his main thing for me. He wanted to see me have fun and enjoy the moment. And I did.
You know, when you, I mean, how does that feel in the sense that, you know, you got in, and I guess this is probably a harbinger of things to come since generally speaking, this ceremony was, the response to it was so much better than in the years when, you know, you have like, you know, the I always feel bad about the Funk Brothers, you know, where you've got the Funk Brothers together and they have to go through their career in 5 minutes, which is like, you know, 2.5 minutes for Terry and 2.5 minutes for Dory. And it was just like, The idea of that is just so mind-boggling, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think they probably realize that it's better to have fewer people and let them, you know, talk longer. And I think last year, even though the idea of the Four Horsemen going in was a really good one, there were six speeches. And there were, only six, five or six honorees this year, and I think that made for a better show. So I think, yeah, I think in years to come they might cut down a little bit. It is a shame about the Terry and Dory not being given enough time, and I think WWE realized that they didn't want to put people in that position anymore.
What did you make of Mr. Backlund?
I was asked the whole stadium.
We're losing you there very quickly. Can you say that one more time?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yeah, this is better.
Yeah. Okay, the day before the Hall of Fame, when we did our international media, I was asked the speech I was looking forward to the most. I said, you know, in 1989, I wrestled a guy. And I said he was a sort of really take me all over the building and brawl. And he taught me a lot. And when I watched the broadcast of one of the matches we had, the announcer once said, this one could go anywhere. Could go anywhere. And I said, that's why I'm looking forward to Bob's speech the most, because it could go anywhere. And it did. He was so laid back. You know, it was so interesting, you know, talking with Bruno and Bob beforehand and Booker, like, and Bob is the most laid back, most polite man you've ever met. And then he just went in a direction that only Bob could go in. So I don't know. I didn't watch the whole thing, but I was laughing and getting a kick out of it. I wonder though, I really wonder if he might regret that, you know, down the line, because you really only get that one chance to have that speech. And I know I've gone over my,
oh, may have lost him, Dave.
Okay.
Mick, are you there? All right, hold on, everybody. We'll get Mick back on the line. All right, we are back here, and we've got Mick on the hotel phone, so he should be good to go from this point forward. And Mick, I believe we were talking about Bob Backlund, and I'm not sure where we were when we got cut off, but I will ask this about Bob. When the show was over, every single person came up to me to ask about Bob, and the exact same question was asked every time. Is he really crazy, or is this just an act? And my conclusion was that his Hall of Fame speech was largely him playing a character, but that he is actually crazy. I'm not sure if I've what you think about this.
I think it's a combination of both. You know, guys famously in wrestling sometimes forget where they, you know, the real person ends and the character begins, or vice versa. And he probably got caught up in it. He's a nice, you know, he's the nicest guy in the world. Like, but even in 1999, in the book, I think I described him. I said he was nice, but he was like scary nice, you know, like writing down his address, telling me to send the photos when they came out, and he'd sign them for me. Like, no one's ever done that. And I think, you know, I actually when I did the Juggalo Championship Wrestling commentary with Kevin Gill, which was actually, you know, a lot of fun considering it started at 4 a.m. After Bob took the microphone and just ranted and raved, took my mic, when I got it back, I just looked at the camera. I said, Bob Backlund, bat bleep crazy. So I think that was a pretty accurate summation. I don't know, but I don't know what the situation was. But before we cut out, I was trying to mention that I wonder if Bob will regret that. Because you only get that one chance, you know, to make that Hall of Fame speech. And, for example, when I watched Bruno's speech, I was so happy that, you know, that there was not a trace of bitterness in there. You know, I think he'd really come to a good place. And it was a great, you know, time of closure. And it was nice to see him and, you know, Vince hugging on stage. And in my case, like, I wish I'd worked out, like, a better ending, you know, a better summation. I should have really written out my closing. Because you only get that one chance to do that speech. And I wonder if Bob, but with that being said, I was very happy in general with how the speech went, and you couldn't possibly have, asked for a better moment than I got with Jericho and Punk. But I do wonder if Bob will regret, you know, doing it in character.
How much of that was planned in advance, and how much of that was just like you had a line you wanted to throw out, and he called an audible?
Oh, with Jericho?
Yeah.
Complete audible. I did tell him last year after the Hall of Fame, I did, as I was walking to the bus, and I realized that we were going to be in New York the next year. I did think, wow, I'd like to drop an elbow on Chris Jericho. Like, that would be my last move. And then the reality is, like, I can't drop elbows anymore. And when Chris went on stage, if you see me talking to him, I said, you better sit up because you're taking all of this. Like, it wasn't the, you know, Mick Foley landing on his hip thing. It was just me landing as hard as I could on Chris. And none of that was, you know, I didn't tell him I was going to say, that was months and months ago, the last time I even mentioned that to him. And so I was not expecting him to get up on stage. When people ask me if it was scripted, I say, yeah, like, we're going to take our top heel.
Yeah.
Have him grant the ultimate babyface moment and then hug the guy on stage before his WrestleMania match. So it was completely ad-lib. What people didn't know is that Punk apparently, like, yelled to one of the referees, get up there. And then the Triple H was in the front row, and he was moving out of his chair to be the he was going to slide in as a ref until he saw that Punk did it. And I didn't even know. I thought, like, when Punk was behind him, I thought, is he, like, setting Chris up, like, for his finishing move? I really didn't know what to expect. And then it all, like, you know, it all made sense. And I figured as long as Chris doesn't mind me dropping my full body weight on him, I'm gonna do this thing. And then the regret comes in where I realize, I couldn't go any higher than that, and I should have brought the speech home right there. So when knowing that the speech would have to be heavily edited for TV, I actually, you know, sent out a couple texts to the producers and said, hey, do you think we could end it, you know, right after the elbow? And yo, Adrian, I did it.
Now, when I saw you get ready for this elbow, because you'd set it up by saying that, you know, I expect that I'd do it, and you'd move out of the way like Lucy and Charlie Brown with the football. And he laid down, and you backed way up. And I thought, okay, he's going to do this running elbow. And then you, like, stopped and kind of walked towards him like you weren't going to do it. And then when you were close, you dropped it real fast. Was that because you had some concern that he might actually move if you had a running start?
No, actually, I you know what? I had concerns that it was going to hurt me for 2 or 3 weeks.
I see. I see.
I didn't, at that point, I didn't think he was going to move out of the way. I believed he was insincere. But I stopped because I was actually, I made the analysis, the risk-reward analysis, that it was going to hurt me for about 2 weeks. And then I, you know, instantly thought, yeah, I'm just going to drop all my body weight on him. And I haven't hurt at all. So that was the right decision to make.
Probably quite fulfilling.
It was. It was. I mean, I don't think you'll ever see a moment like that. I mean, you could try to plan it, but it wouldn't be as special. And I mean, I'll never forget it. Honestly, I put that up there, one of the best moments of my career.
So now, in your mind, given that you know, a couple of times you've thought that was your last move. Is that your last move, or do you think that or are you open to? And I don't think you're going to open to another match at this point. Although I haven't talked to you about that in probably a year, but. Is that your last move?
Well, you know, do you consider Mr. Sacco to be a move?
No. No, no. I mean, I know you can.
I have another one of those left in me, I'm pretty sure. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I could do I could do a move. I don't want to do anything that could be described as a match. I mean, if you remember back to the Santa versus Santa match in Afghanistan with JBL, was not a real physical confrontation. And physically, I probably could do something like that, but I like the idea of not doing any more matches for any reason. But I'm not opposed to doing a move as long as I don't get hurt doing it.
Now, when you know, going on the other subject, because, you know, of course, I saw you at the comedy show a couple weeks ago. When you go on a tour, like, you, I know you've got shows this, you know, tonight, I think tonight and tomorrow, right?
Last night and tonight.
Last night, okay. And then you're going to Europe for a couple weeks.
Yeah.
Now, how much, like, say, well, I saw you in San Francisco, you were in Sacramento the night before. How much of that, if I had gone to Sacramento, would have been repeat? And how much do you kind of, you know, play with the crowd? And, you know, so much of it, to me, seemed like it was, you know, much of your routine was based on answering questions.
Yeah, that's the great thing, is that the questions, you know, result in answers that I wouldn't otherwise have... it would result in stories I would not have otherwise told, and every night kind of brings a new dynamic to it. So I have basically two stories that I tell, that I plan on telling, and then the rest of it I will, you know, I have things that I've done in the, you know, past that I might bring in. I had last year's tour, I had two main stories also that were kind of constant. And I believe I'm gonna try to get them aired this week, so I can't go back and tell them. And I think by airing 14 and 15 minute stories instead of just 2 minute clips, I think people get a much better sense of the, you know, the fun at the shows. I think it's about half and half. You know, when I go to the UK, I won't do what I've done in the past, which is try to do completely new hours in the event that somebody drove, you know, 60 kilometers to a second show. Like that's just making the show suffer. So I have like a little structure, and then I try to improvise and use what's at hand, whether it's a, you know, an interesting character in the front row, or somebody asking a good question, or a history in that city. So every night, you know, I pride myself on making it a little bit different every night, and I also pride myself on the idea that even though it is largely a wrestling show, which took some acceptance on my part, that people who come in who are not wrestling fans end up having fun anyway.
What is the pressure like doing comedy in the sense that if you're doing a wrestling match and you and your opponent screw up a spot, sometimes it's patently obvious something went wrong, like, you know, guy lands on his head or whatever. But sometimes it's like a spot gets screwed up and only the two of you know. And right. So you kind of roll with it and you try your best to cover it up. In comedy, if you tell a joke and it's not funny and no one laughs, like everyone knows. How often do you try out a new joke and it just like it doesn't work, or maybe a certain joke that usually works doesn't work in front of a certain crowd?
Surprising. Oh, go ahead, finish this.
Just asking, how does the pressure compare when like something doesn't quite go right in comedy compared to wrestling? Or at least with wrestling, you've done it forever and you know how to roll with it. And in comedy, it's a little more, it's newer for you.
Yeah. You know what's funny is I had felt a lot of pressure. And there were times, you know, when I was, actually retiring from comedy, and I hadn't done it in like 6 months when I got booked on a show in Plattsburgh, New York. This is going back, almost 2 years now. And, I was booked on a personal appearance and a comedy show in the same city. And the personal appearance did really well. It was like 250 or 300 people. And when I would ask people, if they were going to the show that night, they got visibly like awkward about it. Like they were lying to me, and I knew it, creating reasons why they couldn't come. And that night there were about 70 people at the meet and greet, the VIP meet and greet. And then when I went outside to do the show, oh, there were only 50 in the audience. So 20 people had actually left instead of seeing me do the show. And that's where I realized I had a lot of work to do. At that point, I should have stopped calling it a comedy show and sort of call it an evening with or a one-man show, because people feel like I'm going to be up there telling, you know, bad one-liners, which is not, you know, what I do.
Sure.
But I enjoy going out there and trying new things. And I like the idea that, you know, anything can fail, and sometimes, you know, spectacularly on any given night. I think I became way more comfortable after at Montreal, when I realized Montreal and Edinburgh are the two biggest comedy festivals in the world, and I was lucky I got to do both of them last year. And once I realized that there were, you know, hundreds of great comedians under the same roof, and that if anyone wanted to hear it about anything other than wrestling, there were plenty of places to go. I got much more comfortable with the idea of being the wrestler telling wrestling stories to wrestling fans. Like, I already had an audience, and I was trying to chase them away almost by saying I didn't do, you know, a wrestling show. And since then, I really haven't been nervous. You know, it's really comfortable, and I like, you know, the same way I like bombing in promo segments occasionally on purpose, and I'm really thankful to Jericho for pointing out the one instance in Miami where I did a terrible promo just to make him laugh and make Jack Lanza mad. I will try out some really bizarre stuff just to see if it works, and sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't, and I like to have fun either way.
No, like it was in, I guess I don't even in San Francisco. And I mean, when you're doing it, do you know the difference between a good show or a bad show? Kind of like, I know you would know like a good match and a bad match usually when you're done, you know, you can buy, you know, crowd reaction, things like that. Like in San Francisco, just as an example, Was that a good show, an average show? I mean, I only, because that's the only one I've seen, and I don't know what to
compare
it to.
Yeah, you know what I remember? Yeah, it felt pretty good. Yeah, I thought that was a good show. Last night, for example, I was really tired, you know, flown to Phoenix. I didn't have much sleep. I was a little tired, and, you know, but so I thought it was a little lagging in energy. But people, they really have fun. You know, when I see them afterwards, you know, almost everybody stays. We did the San Francisco meet and greet early because I had to fly out. And that could sometimes hurt the energy of a crowd when you do the meet and greet beforehand. But everybody seemed great, like they had fun. In the past, like the three or four times I'd had my shows recorded, I didn't think I had particularly good shows. And then a couple nights ago, I watched just one handheld camera did my show, one of my shows in Edinburgh. And it was a really good show, really great energy, and I thought it captured not just, you know, the humor, because you know, like I went to see Louis C.K. and I just realized coming out, all right, laugh for laugh, like there's no way I'm going to compete with these guys, but I can tell my stories and they can be interesting without being funny. And that is like the wrestler claiming to go out there and have silent heat, you know, if you're going out there and doing comedy and not getting laughs. But I think there's like a, you know, there's a sense of fun in addition to the funny, you know, there's a sense of fun. And I try to create a sense of warmth there so that people who are not wrestling fans can enjoy themselves too.
I don't know if you noticed this, but I know it from me being in the crowd that it was like a lot of people who were, older fans. I mean, there were people, I mean, like there were, you know, a couple of guys who I grew up with basically, and a couple of guys who were, you know, fans even before I was that were there, and some people who were a little younger, but it was, it was like an audience from, I put it this way, there were far more familiar people to me in the several hundred that were there as compared to if I were to go to anything now. I mean, whether it's an MMA show or a WWE show, I mean, I see a few people I know, but there it was like I was walking, and then the next day with the emails I got, you know, oh yeah, you know, just it seems like it's like it's kind of like the crowd that I probably would have seen. I don't want to put a year in it, but let's say the 90s at a WWE show if I went to the Cow Palace or San Jose, and you know, just the friends that I would have seen, it's like they were pretty much all there, it seemed like, or a lot of them.
That's really interesting, you know. It's just in the last like 6 or 8 months that I think word is getting around, you know, word of mouth, that the shows are good and worth going to. And I haven't really thought of the audience makeup. I know it's interesting that WWE's just done such a good job with the, you know, the website and the DVDs and the action figures and the video games, that I am still kind of relevant to kids who weren't even born when I was wrestling. Tonight I'm doing an all ages show in Flagstaff, but I know in the past that when I do an all ages show, there'll be like four kids there. But yet when I do an appearance, I draw a lot of kids. So it's funny that I have fans who know me, who weren't even alive when I was wrestling, but they don't come out to the comedy shows, even when it's all ages. It's I'm still trying to get my hands around the reasons why.
Well, has that been for a while now, or has it picked up since you became the Saturday Morning Slam GM?
You know what? It did. I think that helped because I was feeling a little bad. I didn't have a website or anything for this personal appearance I was doing, and I try to, you know, I try to get the word out. I feel like I owe that to the people doing the appearances, even if it's a guaranteed, am I getting a guaranteed sum of money? And he goes, like, no, we're going to be fine. And they'd done local advertising, and a lot of the kids were there. They knew me as the Saturday Morning Slam guy, which is great. I love doing it. You know, I really do. And I think there was, when I was approached about it, I think WWE didn't know how I'd react to it, because on one level it's not your Raw or SmackDown GM, but it's, you know, it's fun and it's a positive show, and it really helps me, you know, become a bigger part of be a star in the reading, the literacy campaigns they're doing. And I was, you know, as you, I don't know if you've noticed, but I was willing to give in and concede that maybe the time for the authority figure wearing sweatpants and flannel shirts had come to an end.
Now, not that you would normally do anything like this, but when you're shooting your stuff for Saturday Morning Slam, I mean, obviously you can't shoot your two guns, that sort of thing. But do they come up to you with, because you know you can't choke, you can't hit the head on that show. Any sort of guidelines they give you?
As far as my verbal work,
sure. Not that you do anything, but I mean, is there anything in particular that maybe you never thought about before, but now that it's super PG, it's actually G,
yeah,
they're like, eh.
You know, I try to throw in a little positive positive message. When I do something with Sandow, we try to, you know, put in some kind of, you know, so short English lesson, small English lesson. There's really no. I'm allowed to kind of create the GM character as we go along, in a way similar to how I created the commissioner character as we moved along in 2000. So it's fun, and I'm finding, you know, I have a dynamic with some of the guys, and you know, in almost every case, you know, I think in every case there are people I never wrestled with. But one of the things I loved about being the commissioner in 2000 was that I was able to play off so many. You know, so I had so many great comic foils, and, you know, Kurt Angle and Edge and Christian, and, you know, even Pat Patterson and Briscoe. And I'm finding those guys again, you know, the foils in Damian Sandow and Cody Rhodes, and also like the good guys, Brodus Clay and Sweet Tea. So I'm having fun. They don't really place any parameters on it. There was one, it didn't make the air only because they had to set up a different match. And these shows air because of standards and practices. They air 3 weeks after the fact. So the interview will never make the air, not because of what I said in it, but because it just didn't fit the storyline. But in this case, we were having a little trouble getting the pre-taped on. You know, there's some background noise. Somebody flubbed a line. So it was like our fourth or fifth take. And I knew I'd given a pause. I knew I had paused long enough to make it acceptable. And I was actually playing off what Kurt Angle said to me in 2000, where he came in and he said, "Hey, how you doing, Mick? Hey, I like the beads." And I was wearing a string of beads that my daughter had made for me in kindergarten. And then when I humbled Kurt and told him, you know, your opponent will be The Undertaker, you know, Kurt, in a search for a way to get back at me, just looked at me and said, "I lied about the beads." And he ran off, which is always one of my favorite lines. So Sandow did the same thing, but with my tie. "Hey, I have to admit, I like your tie." And then when I didn't give him the match he wanted, he stormed off. He said, "I lied about the tie." And I said, "What's wrong with my tie?" And then I paused about 2 seconds and said, "You son of a bee." And they all went, "No." They all went crazy. Like, "It's Saturday Morning Slam." And I said, "Don't worry. I paused. You know, I paused long enough." And I wanted them to show Vince just so he would lose his mind. But I think it's just indicative of, you know, having fun and enjoying what you're doing. And, you know, at this point, you know, I'm happy to be on a show and have a role in the company. I really couldn't ask for anything more.
I have to ask you this question. I have never asked anyone this question in my life. I've wondered about it for years. And since you brought it up, I've got to ask you. Every time WWE, I can't say every time, but very often, you'll see a backstage segment, and we'll just say it's one involving you,
okay.
And you do a promo, and then you'll go like, "Yeah," and you'll smile at the screen. And it seems to me like they deliberately leave the camera on you for like an additional 3 uncomfortable seconds. You know what I mean? They do this to everybody. And I've always wondered if it's like, do they just feel like this is the right timing? Or is this purposely done so that everybody has to stand in a goofy position just long enough that they start to feel uncomfortable?
I don't know. I like it, personally. Now that you mention it, there is a few extra seconds there. I don't know. I'm sure there's a reason to it. Just like, you know, there were reasons when I was, you know, announcing, they had reasons that seemed strange, but actually, you know, work much of the time, like the tendency to to lay out and not have announcers talk over action.
Well, layout makes sense. Would they do
extended
it?
Extended
yeah.
periods. I don't know. I'll try to get to the bottom of that. I'm sure there's a reason. I'm sure.
I think it's to let segments breathe, because I know that when with TNA it was always the opposite, that they would always cut things so abruptly, and I always felt watching it that they were it wasn't it just felt like it made the show seem more choppy. And I think
sure.
I think that the segment needs like a breathing moment before you go to the next segment, because if it just chop, it's just like
I agree. That's a good point.
It doesn't have any impact, maybe.
That's probably why they do it.
Hmm. One last question for me, and then I'll let Dave wrap it up. I know you got to get going. It's going back to the Hall of Fame very quickly. At the end of the show, it's kind of funny because like everybody was piling out of the arena, and everybody was on the stage doing their bow and getting their pictures taken and that sort of thing. And I was keeping my eye on Vince, because I had not seen any Vince McMahon, Bruno Sammartino interaction.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Vince was like, he was going as far away from Bruno as possible. He's talking to everybody else and people are filing out. And I'm like, come on, Vince, you know, go shake this guy's hand. And at the end of the day, he went up, he raised his hand, he gave him a hug and that sort of thing. But I don't know if like you had seen anything before the show, or if you knew when they had their first interaction together, what it was like. I mean, did you see them together before that moment, or was that like Vince sucked it up
bit.
Right there?
And I was conscious of that too. It seemed like, you know, there whatever, you know, bitterness had been there had been resolved. I did see a little bit of interaction between them. But I like that moment as well. If I could just speak about two different subjects concerning the Hall of Fame before I go,
sure.
I'd appreciate it.
Yep.
One is there was that day, you know, where it was rumored that my speech was not going to air, and I did. You know, I got a little upset about it. If you look back, the actual breaking news where I acknowledged I might not be on television was an answer to Santa Claus, where I said Santa had said that he might not be able to get to the garden, but he was looking forward to watching it with Mrs. C on television. And then so my big statement was, Santa, not sure, you know, you might want to make it, if you want to see the speech, you might want to see it live, not sure it's going to air on television. So it wasn't like the most, it was not a real confrontational moment. But what I did not realize is going to like release a firestorm of angry mail to Stephanie and to Hunter and to Vince and Trump. And so I think I learned, like, you know, you have to handle the power of social media responsibly. And the more responsible way to handle that would have been to have called somebody at the company and asked them about it, instead of going off. Even though I didn't think it was going off, but it did kind of set off.
That's what I did.
Chain
actually, or no, they called me. I shouldn't say that. Yeah,
about the show.
Yeah, because Brian and I were talking about it on here when they first aired the commercial on USA. And then we talked about it on the show, and then the next day they called me, and that's when they said we're 90% sure that he's going to be on. And then the next thing I know, the show has been increased to 75 minutes, and so
maybe that was the taste, but
it was.
But you know what? The truth is, even if it hadn't aired, it really was far more about the moment being there. You know, of having the time to give this, you know, all the time I needed, and it will be on DVD, and it would not have been a big deal to me. I'm glad it aired. I really am.
You know that they're airing it on internet pay-per-view, I think starting tonight, maybe even.
Oh, it's airing on internet pay-per-view?
I just found that out because I'm actually going to, you know, I watch the TV, but I'm actually going to watch. I think it's $7.95 or so. The price could be wrong, but
it's under $10 for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They just made that announcement, so yeah.
So anyway, that was one thing I learned, is that if you want to do something, the phone call is probably still the most effective way.
Before you go to the second thing real quick, can I just get confirmation that fans were so upset that you weren't going to be on TV that they targeted Trump?
Yeah, poor Trump, you know.
I just find that funny for some reason.
I got this nice text from a tweet from Donald's son, and we had a couple people, mutual friends, who run a great group called Operational Smile that Donald Jr. serves on the board of. So he was, and then Donald himself was actually very gracious and, you know, told me several times he enjoyed the speech. So it was a nice evening. If people want to follow my dates, you know, it's realmickfoley.com. They're really piling up because, clubs are, you know, they're doing well and people are coming out and I'm pretty easy to work with. And so if people want to see a show, they can always just check the calendars. I'm coming to parts of the country I haven't been, beforehand. And then in closing, I'll just say that when I was giving my speech and I mentioned I'd left a ticket for Santa Claus and wondered if anybody had seen him. There were two people. I see my son Mickey pointing to himself going, you know, I saw him. And then Triple H is in the front row and he's got his daughter in his lap and she's waving at me going, yelling, I saw him.
That's awesome.
And I had to pretend I didn't see these two kids telling me that they had seen Santa Claus. So I just thought to close it with a happy. And that was the biggest part of my speech was the most difficult is trying to make people understand why it was important to me to have Santa Claus as part of my speech. And I think in the end they just went, let him do it. We don't get it, but let him do what he wants. So I'm really thankful. I'm happy with the way it ended, the way it went. And I'd asked Ron Simmons the night before if he enjoyed himself. And he said, yeah, I really, you know, he told me he really did. And then he went up there and had some notes, but just spoke from the heart. And my one concern was that I'd go up there and when it was all over, feel like it hadn't lived up to my expectations. And it more than lived up to them. It exceeded them. And I was really happy and honored to be part of it. And, you know, we'll probably put the ring, I'll have something special done with it. So I appreciate the chance to talk about it and hope to talk to you guys again soon.
Yeah, just very quickly, you want to get out all the information about the upcoming shows and one more plug for Twitter and that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah, almost everything. I try to keep it real, Brian and Dave, so it's at Real Mick Foley Twitter. RealMickFoley.com is the website, and even Facebook is Real Mick Foley. There's a lot of dates. I mean, I'm going to the UK. It's actually 3 weeks. I think I'm doing 20 shows in 21 days. So people are listening overseas. You know, there should be something close. I'll hit Ireland probably in November, and then just check the schedule because there's, you know, Calgary and Edmonton and Asheville, North Carolina, and dates in Los Angeles. You're going to do a post SummerSlam comedy show. Let me leave you. I'll tell you something funny. This is a good way to leave it, to give you guys an idea of you know, the fear that can exist when you're up there doing stand up. Some people say it's the most terrifying thing in the world. Dolph Ziggler is a huge fan of comedy. He's like a student of comedy, and he's been working on material for a long time. He was going to do his debut comedy set last night for me in Phoenix. And I could tell he was really worried about it. So I said to him a few days before Mania, I said, so let me get this straight. I said, you're going to go out there in front of 78,000 people. And he said, yes. And I said, and you're going to be fine. He goes, oh, yeah, yeah. I said, but 200 in Phoenix? And he goes, I'm terrified. Like, I'm terrified.
Did you do that?
Like, the day before the show, I said, how about, you know what? I said, it was after he won the World Heavyweight Championship. Which, by the way, I was thrilled about. I actually ran. My arms were moving fast. I don't know what the rest of my body was doing, but I ran out of the hallway into the arena because I wanted to be there for that moment in history. And then afterwards, when we were talking, I said, you know, Dolph, now that you're the World Heavyweight Champion, maybe it's not the best idea to have your first ever set of comedy done, you know, in a place where people are going to have their phones and be able to record this because you might regret it. And he goes, I know him. You know, he was so worried about it. And I said, how about you just join me for the Q&A? And it was like this huge weight was lifted off his shoulders. So he came up last night with me and we had a great time. But I just thought you'd get a kick out of knowing that the same guy who commands the ring in front of 78,000 was a little trepidatious about 200 in Phoenix.
The show off.
show off. It was great in the Q&A. We had a great time, and that's something I'll be looking forward to in the post SummerSlam show. We did that last year, and everyone really enjoyed themselves. But if they go on the website and they check it out, almost everybody is happy that they went.
Now, how often, as far as the Tuesdays, are you, you know, because I know you're in England for 3 weeks now. There, you're actually, you got one Tuesday in London. While you're there, but I mean, as far as like, are you going to be pretty regular on Tuesdays,
I'm going to be pretty regular. You know, there will be situations, you know, where, you know, I might say, "Wow, that's a long way to go to do a backstage segment." So they've been really great working with me. I mean, but, you know, allowing me to do my extra dates and understanding that I can't, you know, I might not want to go to 52 shows a year. And from what I hear, Saturday Morning Slam may actually be a seasonal show.
Oh, really?
They have a season and an ending, and then be picked up and then resume a couple months later. So I'm not sure exactly how many dates I'll be on the road, but there's plenty of things to do, you know, behind the scenes with the company, and I got the okay for the children's book that comes out next April. So you know, my plate's pretty full.
Well, Mick, we want to congratulate you on the newest Hall of Fame induction. And everybody can check out at Real Mick Foley, Twitter, Facebook, the website, everything like that, and all of the upcoming comedy dates and Saturday Morning Slam as well. So thanks so much, Mick, and best of luck on the tour.
All right. Thank you. Talk to you guys soon.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back after a while.